Hello, and welcome to Sherlock, from Adler to Amberley. An attempt to analyse all 56 of the Sherlock Holmes short stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, in order. Starting with the first story, A Scandal in Bohemia, featuring the celebrated adventuress Irene Adler, and finishing with the final story of the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, The Retired Colourman, where Holmes and Watson accept the case from Mr. Josiah Amberley. Hence, from Adler to Amberley. My name is Carl Kopak, and I'll be presenting this irregular series along with a special guest as we attempt to assess the value of each tale of the canon. A recap of The Adventure of the Golden Pince-Nez by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Firstly, well, the first thing I really should say is that I'm probably going to pronounce the word Golden Pince-Nez incorrectly. I know there's various incarnations of it, so just go with me on this one. Anyway, Holmes and Watson are in 221B Baker Street when we begin the serial. Holmes is researching 15th century palimpsest, which I contend the only reason that's been mentioned is so we can enjoy the word palimpsest, because I certainly do. Watson, too, has been reading up on his latest medical researchers and what have you. They're indoors because it's a, well, I imagine there isn't a case to be had, and also because, it's horrific. There's a thunderstorm outside. There's shades of the five orange pips, which, if you remember, started with a storm. On that occasion, they brought in, you know, a client came to the door in the middle of the night, and this time it's Inspector Stanley Hopkins. Holmes and Watson are a little bit worried at first because they think they've got to turn out in this ridiculous weather, and what they're going to do, and that's no good. Please don't make us go out in the middle of the night. But luckily, he's got no designs to. But what he does have is a murder. He's been to a place called Yoxley Old Place, which is in Chatham in Kent. So it's another story where there is in the middle of nowhere. And this one also has a very limited household. This isn't the place for a murder. You know, it's not the East End or anything like that. There are only four people in the house. The leader, if you want to call it that, is Professor Coram, who's a very old man, an invalid, very rarely leaves his bedroom. He's walked around in a bath chair every now and then. He's a scholar. He's working on a book about Egyptian and Syrian churches, I think he said, or something similar to that. This is a story where there seems to be plenty of people researching the driest of subjects, bearing in mind we've just had the three students where Holmes is looking at old English charters in a university town that can't be named, Cambridge. So there's Professor Coram. He's got a secretary called Mr. Willoughby Smith, who's a very nice, quiet man, wouldn't say boo to a goose, no enemies in the world or anything like that. He has Mrs. Marker, who's sort of the chief, you know, the chief maid, and a girl called Suzanne Tarleton, I think their name is. I think it's Suzanne. It is in the BBC adaptations anyway. And so there's four of them, and they get along together. Don't really go out. They don't really do anything out of the ordinary. But one day, Hopkins is there because Willoughby Smith, the secretary, has been stabbed. He's been stabbed in the face and neck and throat as well. And there's no motive whatsoever for why he would be killed. There's only three other people in the house, as I've said. Two of them are servants. They weren't anywhere near the room, and they can vouch for each other. And, of course, the professor was in bed, and he genuinely was in bed. You could say, oh, yeah, but he snuck down. He had some beef against whatever. But he really didn't. There's absolutely no motive for this killing whatsoever, because he's got no enemies, and it really is another locked room mystery. The only clue they've got is he says, when he was dying and when the maids were trying to save his life, he said, the professor, it was she. This may refer, and I'll be honest, it does, to the fact that earlier that day, Smith had been walking around Chatham or Yoxley Old Place in general, and he's bumped into a woman who asked where the house was. He didn't say, oh, I live there, it's here. But And he mentioned this to Professor. Oh, I met this woman who said wants to know where the house is, so that it could, and indeed it does refer to her. But the next thing you know, there's a scream coming from the study, and then you know, there he is, and he's been stabbed. This weird thing about it is there's a pair of golden pons nez. So if you don't know what pons nez are, or indeed how to say it correctly, as I do, they are a small pair of sort of rounded glasses which are perch on the nose. Very sort of de rigueur for the times, less so now. So they can't work, because they think it must be her as well. Of course, and Holmes leaps on this straight away and automatically deduces that the woman's short-sighted, she's got a bucket forehead, her eyes are far apart, or too narrow, one or the other. So we've got a big sort of scene about deductions. They're just looking at what they look like. They've been repaired in the last 12 months, that sort of thing. The thing he really loves doing, and we love listening to his readers. The only clue, really, there's an absence of a clue, is that there's absolutely no way they can work out how the woman got in and left again. Because, you know, there are some indistinct footmarks around the path outside. But there's no way of finding where they left. This person didn't leave. So, of course, Holmes and Watson says, oh, OK, we'll go down in the morning. We're definitely going to go and do that. They do that, and, of course, they meet all the staff and they meet the professor. And they have a look around and study the study. And they look at the bureau. And it looks like something's been going on with the bureau in the secretary's desk, like someone's had to try and break into it, and there's some nonsense about a key and it's had to scraped on the lock, so you know someone's tried to break in to a desk within that office. They go and see the professor who's in his room. He seems a jolly old soul to say, like, you know, there's been a murder downstairs. And he says, oh, and I never leave this house. I've had a secretary in the past, but, you know, they had to leave. And I'm not really happy with, you know, I can't get the staff. And now this poor man is dead, and he's going to, and it's going to affect my studies. And he's all very, very jolly. He keeps offering Holmes cigarettes because... Holmes says, I'm a connoisseur, and he smokes something like 4 in 15 minutes, which I don't smoke myself, never have done, never will, but I think that's pretty much impossible. These are Egyptian cigarettes and they cost a bomb, so Holmes says, oh, I'd like another one of those. He smokes them, and he said, I'm going to have a walk around and I'll see what's going to happen. But and the professor says, maybe he took his own life, and he said, and Holmes sort of, you know, says, well, you know, maybe he humours him, really. And they go down and meet the staff again and have another look round. And he's interested in why he was trying to break into the bureau. A bit later on, they come back upstairs again to meet the professor again. And once again, Holmes says, can I have some more cigarettes? He does that and has more and more cigarettes. Earlier, he told Mrs. Marker that he said, I bet the poor professor's not been eating, you know, with all the tragedy and what have you. He said, actually, he's been eating a fair bit, and he's ordered a very big lunch. And Holmes is very pleased at that news. So they go and speak to the professor again, and he said, oh, you know, what's going on? What do you think's happened to him? And he says, this is your chance to tell the truth, professor, because obviously the professor's involved in some way. And he says, maybe you'd like to come out, madam. And a woman comes out of a small, I would say priest office, that's like a bookcase, really. She comes out. She announces herself as the wife of the of the Professor Corum. So no, I won't name his name, he's Russian, I won't name his name. Anyway, Sir Guy, so she names his name straight away. What had happened was she'd gone to get the papers because a previous lover... So basically, Professor Corum, Sir Guy, and her had been lovers. He's much older than her. He was a tutor. She was a student. They were involved in some sort of revolutionary gang, and he basically, when things got a bit hot, they broke up. She took a lover, and they were a peaceful political process. And the professor basically just gave him up, and now he's in a camp, and I imagine in Siberia or something like that. So she'd actually gone to his house to break into us to get the papers to get the man, her lover, released. When she was in there, she wasn't expecting the Willoughby Smith to be there. And he knocked the golden pons thing out off her face, and she just grabbed hold of the first thing she could and bushed him in the face, which was a knife, a sealing wax knife. Didn't mean to kill him, and she escaped. And because there's coconut matting outside the room in either direction, she thought she was going to run out to the garden. Because she's so short-sighted because of the, you know, her glasses had gone, she actually ran upstairs, admitted everything to the professor, and he said, okay, well, we'll sneak you out once this detective fella's gone. And he hid her in a priest hole. The Holmes worked it all out anyway, because by the reason he'd be basically putting cigarette ash all over the floor was so that he could trample into it and see... leave it fresh and see if anyone had trampled it, because the professor couldn't disturb it because he was in bed. So someone who's in that room, and he spotted a little corner where there's a little gap where someone could hide. She basically tells the story about what a treacherous swine he's been, but then she takes her own life. She swallows, she took some poison or other before she revealed herself, which seems to be very, very slow working, and or works at exactly the right time, and she dies. And that's the end of the Golden Pince-Nez. Our guest to discuss the adventure of the Golden Pince-Nez is Catherine Cook. Catherine joined us on previous serials such as Black Peter and The Solitary Cyclist, both of which she adores, and we're looking forward to hearing her views on the Golden Pince-Nez now. Joining us to discuss the adventure of the Golden, and there's some debate about this already, I'm going to go with Pince-Nez because that's what Clive Merrison says in the BBC Radio 4 adaptation, is Catherine Cook. You're back again, Catherine. You helped us out with The Solitary Cyclist and Black Peter, and you're back with to discuss Russian nihilists. Mm-hmm. How much a person can smoke in 20 minutes, which I'm particularly interested in, having never smoked in my life, and murders that aren't murders. Well, firstly, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I've just just a week in Italy, so finding it a bit chilly. Right.
Where did you go?
Sorrento, largely to do Pompeii and Herculaneum properly.
Oh, very nice. I went camping in Suffolk at the weekend. It's not quite the same thing.
No, I can imagine it wasn't. Whereabouts in Suffolk?
A place called Eastbridge near Leyston. Right. It's near Sizewell, probably the sort of most famous area around there.
Right. Because I come from East Anglia originally, but that's not...
Oh, do you? Whereabouts?
I was brought up in Essex, on the Essex-London border, but my mother came from Norfolk, so we spent a lot of time driving through Suffolk.
Okay, I'm in Norwich at the moment.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. My mother was at Norwich Training College before it was bombed in the Second World War.
Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, there you go. Interestingly, I was in Newmarket today, the Newmarket Racecourse, for a work thing, and there's a big old map on the wall and it says Newmarket Heath. And I thought, where have I heard Newmarket Heath? And it's referenced in Shoshkam Old Place. Yeah. At least it is in the radio version, where Sam Brewer took a horsewhip to somebody.
And I thought, I'm pretty sure it's in the story. Certainly the incident of the horsewhip is in the story.
Yeah. As I was trying to think straight away, I've got to stop thinking of terms in Sherlock stories. Every time I see North Walsham, I know that's where they get off the train and the Dancing Men.
Well, it's not a bad way to find your way around Britain.
It's very handy, yeah.
Just don't leave boxes train times.
Yes. And of course, Sir Arthur's knowledge of London, which we often discuss on this show. John! Hello!
Hello!
John's on mute. Hello. You've been running around the country with former Doctor Who stars, haven't you?
I've been conventioning, again, going to some of the filming locations and... having pictures with Sophie Aldred in costume to make you jealous, Carl.
Yes, I'm taking that very well. Bit of a crush on Sophie Aldred when I was, I'll be honest, when I was far too old to have a crush on people like that.
Now I'm going to have to say that I remember William Russell, and I'm so sorry to see that he died recently.
Oh, I know.
Was he 99?
Yeah.
He was 100, I think. Or near enough.
Yeah, I think he was a month shy of 100, something like that.
All right.
Close enough. We're counting as 100.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's possibly a way I can segue between William Russell, who played Ian Chesterton in the early Doctor Who's, into the Golden Pince-Nez. And yes, I can do it. Because in the Radio 4 adaptation, the woman, as she's known, just the woman or Anna, is played by Maureen O'Brien, who played Vicky.
Vicky, yeah.
Who was in Doctor Who in the 60s as well, and with William Russell.
At the same time as William Russell, yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
I will fi always find the Doctor Who Sherlock link if I can possibly get one.
I'm seeing her at the convention in August as well.
I met her on the same day I met Sophie, in fact. Sorry, this is a Sherlock podcast. We will be getting there. We do have a guest. But we will be getting there at some point. I also met the woman who plays Dodo, Jackie Lane, I want to
Jackie
say.
Jackie Lane, yeah.
I met her at Manopticon in 1990. Catherine, I think we might have my first ever slight difference of opinion here with a guest. When I ask you the question, do you like the Golden Pince-Nez?
Yes, I do.
I know that because you told me on email, but what is it about the story that you like?
One of the things about the story, actually, it's a lot of people don't like it, or it's actually quite ignored. I remember actually many years ago, we had somebody gave a talk to the Sherlock Holmes Society of London as to why you should not ignore the Golden Pince-Nez. We've also got a slight disagreement on pronunciation. I like it. I think
there's going to be three different. John's going to go with Pince-Nez. So, yeah.
Because I'm common.
Yeah, it's true. That is very true.
I think it's a nice classic story. You've got the setting in Baker Street. You've got the weather howling outside the window. Then you've got not the client coming in a way, but you've got Hopkins, who in effect is Holmes's client for this one, who gives the statement of the case. And then Holmes sort of throws a few deductions around, showing off as usual.
Including an absolute beauty.
Yeah.
With the telegram.
Yes. And then goes down, you know, they go down to the site and see the site. Some of the deductions do, when you just reread it, you think, this is a bit trite, really. But you've then got the denouement, as the villain is unmasked, if you can call her a villain, or which one is the villain, actually. And then you've got just return to Baker Street, tie up a few loose ends and things and make it nice and neat.
Yeah, see, that's a very good argument.
I remember the talk some years ago. And the other thing is, you have got in the space of the first paragraph or two, all those wonderful untold cases.
Yeah.
I want to know what the singular contents of the ancient British barrow was.
Yeah.
And is it the same as the tragedy, or are those two different ones?
The red leech. The red leech, I want to know more about, because it sounds so.
Yeah, the red leech,
doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I just love any single reference that has Leslie Klinger reaching for an encyclopedia somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the first thing I thought of when I saw the red leech. But we're going to be talking about them. We should talk about unpublished stories at some point, because we're going to do this much later. But I have a theory that the giant rat of Sumatra is far more interesting than the Sussex vampire from whence it came. It just is. And I think, yeah, yes. And every single reference, it's referenced in the BBC Sherlock as well. Mm. I love all the unpublished stories. They're just, I have a theory that basically he just wrote down the title or the idea and just never got round to doing it and thought, I'll just shove that, as he did with John's favourite story, Case of Identity, where he mentions Mary Sutherland. And then writes about her. The second stain he mentions and then wrote about it 11 years later. Mm. I think there's a lot of that. John, break the tie here. What do you think about the Golden Pince-Nez?
So I actually couldn't remember a single thing about this story.
Really?
Reading it.
I think that's the problem with it.
Yeah, it's just, I've obviously read it before, and when I reread it, I was like, oh, I remember this part, and this the smoking all those cigarettes and stuff like that. But I couldn't remember anything. But I really enjoyed it. So I don't know why it just wasn't memorable before. I might have forgotten about it by tomorrow now.
Well, I think one of the things I remember about it, and I hope I'm right in saying this because I haven't had a chance to go and check, but it was done by Granada, and I'm pretty sure that Frank Finlay played the professor.
Oh, really?
And I think
it's
that's
a Mycroft story, isn't
why
it?
I remember
In the Bright story, it's actually a Mycroft story.
That I don't remember.
I think I'm fairly sure I think he was.
I will have to dig it out and watch it now.
Yeah, Frank Finlay plays Professor Coram.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think possibly one of his last roles, because he's been gone a long time.
Oh, okay. In the Radio 4 version, it's Maurice Denham,
Oh, yeah.
who's just magnificent because he's got all that, the sort of old little professor like grumbles, and his cough is great because of course he coughs all the way through it because he can't stop smoking. So I think that's
And
pretty good. I wouldn't
Mycroft
really
is in
say
it as well.
it's
Sorry?
on Matisse Mycroft story. I
It
thought
is a
so.
Mycroft one.
Because poor old Jeremy Brett wasn't well enough to do it. I think it's not really a problem I have with the Golden Pond thing. I think some of these stories around this time suffer a bit for me just because we've had such a big run of the classics from Naval Treaty. We've just done the last story we covered was the Three Students, which I think basically falls off a cliff compared to what's gone on before it. But it's all right, and I think Golden Pond's like that. It's very clever. There's two fantastic things in it. The priest hole. Oh, actually, it's a cupboard she's in, isn't it? The woman in the cupboard, and the whole cigarette thing, I think is just incredibly well done. And thinking on, I don't know why I'm sort of I think more ambivalent in one another because it's a Hopkins story, and I love Hopkins because I just think he's just slightly out of his depth and just about covering himself. And Holmes isn't nasty to him really.
No. It's often said he's Holmes is sort of almost mentoring him. He's probably the most
Yeah.
popular policeman in Holmes's view. And he's not making stupid mistakes. He gets quite a lot
No.
wrong.
It just lacks a bit of imagination, and as it says in Black Peter as well, you didn't provide an argument against your own theory, which you can't do. You've got to falsify every single thing you come up with, and
He
whatever
does.
remains, etc.
He does get a bit condescending to Hopkins in this one, though, when he's
Of
like,
course he
"Well,
does, because he's.
what were you doing when you weren't discovering anything or something like that? You know, were you finished?" True.
Oh dear me. But yeah, I think I like it that I like the fact that it basically starts off as the five orange pips because old Watson he loves a storm in Baker Street, doesn't he? Absolutely adores it. So that's really I think there's everything in that's just really good. I do love the deduction of the this is a woman who is blah 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 blah. And of course when she comes out he's exactly right, which is an interesting thing. Once again, it's a story. When we started doing this show, John and I sort of kept a tab for a while about where scenes are set, where the stories are set. And once again, we've gone as remote as possible. So I'm thinking of in terms of, I mean, I suppose the most famous one is Copper Beaches, Speckle Bands, things like that. They're all sort of away from London. A bit difficult to get to. You can't get them in an hour. They've got to start in the morning and things like that.
Well, Holmes does talk about the smiling and beautiful countryside actually being far more dangerous than the crowded
Yeah.
city. Because in the
Yeah.
city, you've got neighbours who
Yeah.
hopefully would spot something and say something. But once you're away, once you're out at these big isolated houses, you haven't.
Yeah. And I also love that he references in this that I think it Hopkins says the people in this house only know the people in this house because he never gets out of bed. And Mrs. Marker and Tarleton are quite happy to just, stay where they are. Oh, sorry, I thought we froze them for a second. So it's again, it's another theme of Conan Doyle's. It's the remoteness of life around it. And I think that's quite an interesting theme because I think this story is about sort of the dangers of solitude as well, as much as anything else. And some of these dangers of solitude and actual murder. And then, yeah, you're slowly winning me around here, Catherine. You're not getting me on the Mazarin stone. Don't get me on that. But
That'd be interesting discussion, that.
we've been saying for a while about the Mazarin stone that when I always ask the question, if you've come people because people say, I want to go and do that story. I'll cover that story with you. Which one wouldn't you want to do because you don't like it? Mazarin stone is by far. In fact, we John didn't we take it out of the ratings in sort of if you disliked a story as well as the Mazarin Stone, which were the
yeah, it's now apart from the Mazarin Stone, which
which one would it be? But interesting, when we come to do this, Catherine, we've actually got a guest who likes it.
Well, I think there's stuff in it, especially if you actually take it in conjunction with the play The Crown Diamond,
and that's
it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to ask who's interested in doing it?
Go on, John. It's John's friend.
It's Dr. Nico, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good.
So that's going to be a four-hour show, which I go which I go through the story line by line and then say, huh, at the end of every single one of them. Now, the other one, by the way, is Three Gables. No love for that at all. I think for fairly obvious reasons why that would be. But back to the Golden Pond tonight. It's an ingenious story. But one thing I don't think they do, he pays much attention to is poor Willoughby Smith.
Mm.
All he's done is say hello to someone in the street. That's all he's done. And then a minute later, he's got a blade in his neck. And not much is made of the fact that the reason that Anna's got into the house, sorry, my dog's barking again. The reason that Anna's got back into the house is because there was a previous secretary who's obviously done some work against Professor Coram or Sergius, as he is. I really like that. Again, it's the remoteness for me. Look, this tiny place, this tiny village in Chatham, just near Chatham, and now we've got Russian nihilists running around the place trying to track down a former traitor. That's got to be unique, surely.
Actually, I was just thinking of The Secret Agent and trying to remember when that was published.
I did that for A-level. It's about the same time.
Yeah, so
this
did
is
I.
What, 19, this is, what, 1905?
Yeah.
Which, in fact, I still use the term ticket of leave apostle to this day, having no idea what it means. Michaelis was always described as the ticket of leave apostle. And I lived in Greenwich, so this was a big thing for me. Yeah, I went to Greenwich University. That was quite a nice thing.
Quite a few Conan Doyle short stories, quite a few of the Sherlock canon, does almost cross into espionage, though, if you think about it.
Oh, it does. I mean, it was the period of the Riddle of the Sands and that sort of aspect of British life. So he's really tapping in, and it's more so in some of his non-Sherlock Holmes stories as well, I think.
Yeah, he has a little dabble with Sherlock, though. Second Stain is obviously and my absolute favourite, Bruce Partington Plans.
Mm.
And his last bow, obviously.
I forgot about that one.
Just
yeah.
So you know.
That's just the entire world. Yeah, that's quite popular, that one. Yeah, so, but this is it the only time he mentions the Russian thing? Obviously, because there's a Russian, I read the Leslie Klinger version last night, and the 1904, 1905, there's a Russian alliance, and I can't remember what it was now, but so Russians are in people's minds when they're reading this.
Hmm.
Less so today. I didn't actually know.
Did tap into what was going on at the time.
Yeah. In the news. Yeah. Because, of course, he's got to sell the stories as well, so he's got to bring it sort of up to date. And I think maybe that's taken from that's where we've changed from missing diamonds and Henry Baker losing his hat and Baker and in Tottenham Court Road to suddenly Mycroft and States and Mrs. Trelawney Hope and things like that. And yeah, I think that's a bit of a change. So there is a bit of a marked difference between. I mean, obvious reasons for Conan Doyle, because he was basically just trying to get them out because they made money at this point. And I think this is around the time when, although there are still great stories to come, are there many great ones after this? I'm not really sure. Bruce Partington Plans is what I would say. His last bow was pretty good, obviously. But
yeah, I think there are, and I think a lot of people, we got to be a bit of a catchphrase over casebook's rubbish. Holmes was never the same after he came back from Reichenbach.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's fully true. I think it
Thor
may
Bridge.
Be. Yeah.
Thor Bridge is fantastic.
Yeah.
Just so clever.
I can't remember what I was watching, but it was something not long ago, a modern detective thing on television. And I just sat there thinking, this is Thor Bridge. Honestly, can't remember what it was now, but it was that sort of thing.
Well, I can tell our avid listeners that At one point, I was going to call this podcast "A Chip in the Balustrade," which is a line just I like from Thull Bridge, and I thought that's even too niche for me. So, but yeah, I love Thull Bridge. But Golden Pond Tonight, can we talk about the description he writes down of the woman? And it's very, very funny, and is it over the top? I know it's going to be over the top just because we just need a laugh occasionally because we've had the storm and there's a man, innocent man, dead and no one knows how.
I think to us it sounds a bit over the top, but if you go back 120 years, I think it may not have been so much then because, you know, spectacles weren't as good. People didn't have them. They couldn't have done anything. She had really, really bad eyesight, although I must admit if it was that bad, I think she'd have been carrying a second pair of glasses. I always do when driving. So, in that sense, possibly. Whether the Holmes's deduction is that she's got a thick nose, but her eyes are very close together, actually,
because he can't see through the center.
Yeah. Because he can't get his eyes into the center of the glasses. Whether that really holds water, I'm not so sure. I have got a pair of pince-nez. I got them for use with costume because modern glasses don't really work. They're not much use to me now because I need varifocals and there's not enough glass. But they're actually very difficult to keep on.
I've always thought that.
Very uncomfortable, and you get a little sort of ear chain and a bit of wire around your ear and a chain in case they drop off.
I've always thought that about the same thing with monocles as well.
Hmm.
I mean, just as a Patrick Moore fan myself, they just seem to be more problematic than they were. I think
Lord Peter Wimsey's fan is very useful.
Sorry, John.
You have a permanent squint to a monocle, haven't you, to hold it in? It's
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to sort of squeeze your face down to get it on.
I suppose you get used to it, especially if you've been wearing pince-nez monocle all your life.
But has Anna?
Well, Holmes says she's had really bad eyesight all her life, which is why she peers around and is virtually blind.
On Hans Scholder.
She can't be that old because she was, was it 30 years younger than Coram when she married him?
Yeah. When they married.
Yeah, so she can only be 30 something, I'd have thought.
Yeah. I mean, all I know about pince-nez, and bearing in mind I can't even say the words, is that they all seem to me to be for the middle class and upper. Around this time, like, there aren't many people walking around London with them unless they, you know, they're a bit more refined. I might be completely wrong with that, which is why I don't really get the Russian nihilist who suddenly got them and seems to have them for a while and loved them so much that they you know, fixed them rather than replace them. Or
well,
that didn't sit well with me.
Well, the thing that struck me is that she's been in a Siberian labor camp or something for however many years.
Where and everyone wears them.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, and yet they're gold. And she's quite well-dressed, or Holmes says she's well-dressed because she has golden pince-nez. But possibly the golden pince-nez, the actual wire bits, so to speak, predated her marriage and everything. She came from quite a good family, and she has to have them repaired because now she can't afford anything else.
Yeah.
I don't think the Victorians, the Edwardians, I'm not sure they actually had spectacles in the sense we have them, you know, the side pieces and everything.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the alternative would have been for her.
I'm pretty sure the Victorians did, but they were like much longer and almost like totally hooked over the years.
Yeah, sort of
I'm sure I've seen those dating back to at least the 1870s or something. But for me, if you're practically blind, what are your survival chances in a Siberian, you know, gulag?
We're not suggesting here for a second that he's just used it because it's a good title. Because it really is a good title. That and missing three quarter, I have no idea what that is, but I want to read about it.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense. One person we haven't mentioned, or we've barely mentioned, is John Hamish Watson. And we always have Watson Watch on this show. And I think this, once again, is going to be quite a short Watson Watch. But there's one scene I particularly think I really like in it, is when Holmes is talking to Mrs. Marker, who he's only just met, and bearing in mind that she's just seen there's a dead body on the floor the day before. Watson waxes lyrical about just how charming Holmes can be, which I think flies in the face of what we normally get with Holmes. And particularly again in the BBC Radio 4 version, Holmes gets it all wrong when he has this conversation. He's like, "And then death is done," and he's always quite gets quite animated about it. But I think this is the first time I've ever read that Holmes has got a bit of a charm with the staff and the ladies and what have you. Is that out of character, do you think?
No, I don't think it is. I'm pretty sure there are other instances with people like Violet Smith and the woman in Case of Identity whose name momentarily escaped me.
Mary Sutherland.
That's it, Mary. So he had this remarkable, I think Watson actually uses the phrase, remarkable ability to soothe people. And he's doing it to get the story out of them, and he kind of loses interest immediately he's got it. But it does come up elsewhere.
Yeah, he's an actor as well, isn't he? So
Yeah, that's true.
you know how to act towards people and things like that. I mean, he's charming enough to get engaged in one story, so.
There is that, yeah. The incredibly morally dubious Milverton. He's just as bad as we when we discussed it with Tanya when we did Milverton, and we think that in that story, Holmes and Watson are the only people who break the law. Blackmail's not legal, but it's very difficult to prove. Yeah, so that's quite an interesting that really stood out for him because again, it's not really a Watson story. He's doesn't really know what's going on, and again,
Gas
we've
at the
got to
door.
see that through.
We've
Yes,
written a
indeed.
textbook on surgery, though. He's keeping up with his medical
I'm coming
knowledge.
to this.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I'm going to come to this in a minute. Yes, his sole task seems to be replacing Mrs. Hudson and opening the door because she's gone to bed. That's the action we get from Watson in this story. Which is now the reason I'm interested in that is we've got Holmes and his palimpsest. In the last story we did, Three Students, he was researching, was it John Old English Charters? And of course, I'm going to ask you anyway, would you be reading Professor Coram's book about Syrian and Egyptian, I don't know what it is now. It's just statues or something. I can't remember what it is. But for some reason, it's taken him 30 years to write, and there's tons of paper all over the place. This seems to be a little run towards their researches, what they do at night, they research things more than anything else. And they seem to be, I'll be honest, the driest of topics, though.
Well, is Professor Coram really writing this book, or is it all part of his persona of being this English professor and in hiding? Because what would you expect an English professor to do if he was at home all day?
Yeah, I can see that. Just write something that no one's going to possibly read,
Yeah,
so
and
therefore no one's going to look at it.
haven't really been keeping secretaries. Okay, we've gone, no one of them was a plant and just left, but maybe Willoughby Smith would have seen through him as well. After a bit.
Did the previous secretary leave, or because I mean, again in the radio version, I think it's hinted that that he was discovered by Coram and was
In the
effectively
text, I'm
been.
pretty sure he said that once he got the information for Anna, she says he wouldn't take it any further and left.
It
Oh,
does.
okay.
Yeah. The
Yeah.
second secretary was the detective that Anna employed, and he left because he wouldn't carry out the burglary.
Oh, okay. I seem to have missed that bit for some reason. Okay. And hence why he really, really loves Willoughby Smith. That estimable young man, he calls him. And but I suppose if he's going to keep up the pretense, I mean, he is employing someone to do the work for him as well. Or maybe that's what he's doing. You're doing all the writing. I'm just hanging just up here, not being a treacherous Russian nihilist.
Think he dictates. I think it says Coram
That's right. Yeah,
dictates to
he
him.
does. Yeah,
So, yeah.
he does. I'll come on to the biggest question for this for me. How many cigarettes can you smoke in a 5-minute conversation?
I don't know. I'm a rabid anti-smoker. I've never smoked in my
And so
life.
am
My
I.
father and brother smoked a pipe, so I
So
guess
I'm.
it'd take about 3 minutes to smoke a cigarette. But don't forget, they're
Yeah,
specially made, so we don't know
Egyptian ones. Of
how
course, they're
big.
Victorian as well, so they could just be, mostly paper for all we know.
Yeah, plus
Or very short by our standards.
he said he gets 1,000 cigarettes a fortnight, so
A
that works
thousand,
out
yeah.
like 71 a day.
Wow. I can't believe he's ill.
I know, we support
yeah.
it.
I can't believe he's alive, frankly.
But it is an ingenious device, isn't it? The scattering of the ash. And even Watson's appalled, which doesn't happen too often, just how much smoking he's done. It's also, we should also talk about how clever he is when he deduces that. Well, the way he says to Mrs. Marker, I don't suppose he's eating much at the moment, knowing full well that he is, because he has to get the end of the meal for Anna. I think that's obviously that's the sort of the crux of the story. That's how he discovers it. But I think that's my favourite bit when he's been doing that. I think it's also very it's there are lots of things which are overlooked in this story, and he knew which bookcase it was just by the fact that there was no books in front of it, because obviously there's lots of. I mean, every time I'm thinking about the Stephen Fry, Donald Trefusis, the professor who's in his columns in the 80s, where he said, that he just used the way to get to his desk was to basically just go through a ton of the books which he'd written, which he'd piled up around like a little labyrinth, which always makes me think of Professor Corcoran's room. But I think that's very it's ingenious the way he says, straight away I knew which one it was because the books have clearly been moved. And okay, it's okay. I quite like the Golden Pond stain now. I think that's quite nice. It's a horrible murder, which I
It is.
think again is overlooked. I mean, it's just a horrible sort of an accidental. That's quite grim. And also, I love the way Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, plants the murderer's name in the dead man's mouth, which I know he's done before. Professor, it was she. So he's obviously gone upstairs and said, "Oh, there's a woman asking about this house before." I think that's very well done. It's almost like he knows what he's doing. The great detective. I'm not quite sure what else we can talk about for the Golden Pond's name now. There was something I was going to ask.
I'm just thinking though that Holmes and Hopkins deduced it's the woman that these boys saw in the village that he must have been talking about and stuff like that. But if Holmes hadn't deduced that and Lestrade had deduced that, you could barely be mocking it in about 5 seconds. The same as the Rachel in Study in Scarlet.
Yeah, Raka, yeah. Yeah, we can do that. There's actually one thing we haven't spoken about, which is very important for me, is the spelling of coconut matting, which he spells with an A in the book. Which annoys me as again, I've not mentioned the coconut matting thing, which again is very clever. There is I read Leslie Finger's annotated Holmes yesterday, as I always do for these shows, and it never occurred to me until I read about it. There's a huge problem with it when she says she's explaining to Holmes who he is. His name I will not say. And in the next line, she says, "How dare you, Sergius?" It is "Don't tell him your name, Pike," isn't it?
Well, I suppose it's only his first name, and it could be as common as John.
And which it is, I think, yeah. To George, possibly. I don't know. It's equivalent to that. I may be wrong on that. Yeah, I thought that was quite fantastic. And he's very fawning towards her. "My life is in your hands, Anna," and I think that's very well done. I've looked at Wikipedia before this, and the Clive Merrison, Michael Williams version differs from the book in as much as they take her away to the train station to arrest her at Charing Cross. And she jumps in front of a train, and that sort of there's a foreshadowing of that because they talk when Corum's talking to Holmes and Watson, and I imagine Hopkins, although he's barely mentioned. they're talking about, oh, I don't get to read novels. Have you read Anna Karenina, Mr. Holmes? It's a shameful book about a wife who deserts her husband, knowing full well that she can hear him. And of course, Anna Karenina throws herself in front of a train, which is what Anna does in the BBC version. In the Brett story, I think that Professor Gorham is killed at the end, or at least attacked by some Russian nihilist who's never been seen before. I might have got that wrong. That's just my vague memory of it. But it's interesting how, obviously, she poisons herself in the book. That there's different versions of how Anna should kill herself before the boys tottle off to the Russian embassy with the papers. I find that's quite strange. How everyone seems quite prepared to change the ending of it for some reason. Like it doesn't fit. She also says that she takes the poison before she comes out of the cupboard. She must know a lot about the efficacy of that poisoning.
Maybe it was one the nihilists used a lot.
Yeah, possibly. It was one of their things.
There's quite a discussion of it in the Liz Klinger's book about, well, it can't therefore be opium or one of the ones, because she's quite lucid right up till the end.
And incredibly animated and, you know, and passionate about what she's saying, which is, yeah. So maybe that's why a few people thought, okay, tell you what, we'll just throw her up in front of a train instead, or
it's more dramatic. It's more dramatic, you know, for audio, you know, someone jumping in front of a train than, oh, I took this poison 5 minutes ago, I'm dead, you know.
Yeah, but especially after some of the more recent accidents with trains, you could sort of feel sorry for the train driver and the stoker if she put herself in front of a train.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's the only problem with the, apart from the fantastic, I'm not going to say what Sergius's name is. Maybe that's the only disappointing thing with it. So on the whole then, Golden Pensnez, Catherine, you're a big fan. John, you've remembered what it is now.
Yeah, what's your opinion of the Golden Pensnez then, Carl? Have we converted you?
It's not bad. I mean, I've always sort of quite liked it. And I think the cigarette thing is ingenious. That, you know, the little priest hole thing is ingenious as well. And I've forgotten about the telegram bit, which I absolutely love. I've got a sad feeling this might be Hopkins' last story. I'm not entirely sure it is. I have to look that up. But I don't think it's been it since Black Peter, I think. So he doesn't do that many of them. So it's got everything. I don't know what it is. It's got everything there for me that I really like. And it's got a nice big mistake in it, which makes me laugh. But I don't know. I think it's just because I think when I first read them, I was like, classic, classic, classic. Three Students is a bit weird, but it's not brilliant, but it's okay. And then I think you're right. I think this one just gets a bit forgotten.
I think we've got one more Hopkins story. Abbey Grange.
That's Hopkins, yeah. In fact, it's a brilliant one as well. We've actually only got three stories left now. Sorry?
You've got that to look forward to.
Yes, I do really like the Abbey Grange. Yeah, because where murder is okay. Anyway, we've actually only got three stories left of the return of Sherlock Holmes. And then we get into his last bow. The next story we're going to be looking at is The Missing Three-Quarter. And Madeline's come back for that. Madeline's not been on since, I want to say, Silver Blaze. No, that was Mary. I'm going to cheap and look. Oh, Madeline did the Greek interpreter. So, in fact, just to emphasize my point there, so the stories in order before this was the Greek interpreter, classic, naval treaty, final problem, empty house, Norwood Bill, which I really like, even though John doesn't, Dancing Men, Solitary Cyclist, Prior School, Black Peter, Milverton, Napoleons, and then Three Students and Golden Pensnez. So I'm going to defend myself there. I think that's why such a big run. We always end this show as well by my asking John, Conan Doyle didn't put this in his top 12 or 21 or anything like that, did he?
I should have this list ready, really, shouldn't I?
It's now the end of the show. We do this every show now, John. I won't bother with the Mazarin Stone. I won't ask you on that one. Although, of course, he liked it.
So the 12 best stories. If I've got to
I
click
don't think
through,
it's definitely
that's
not.
someone I'm looking at. I don't think it's you. The technology's failing me. I'm just going to say no.
I think we're both settled for no.
And
if we're wrong, do
re-record
write
this
in.
Part if I'm wrong, but I'm gonna here we go.
Yes, it is, Carl. You're
yeah,
Simon
it's not you.
Stoops.
It's not you. It's not on the list.
It's a good story. But Catherine, thank you very much. This is your third show. No one's ever done four, but you are going to be the first person to do four because you're invited on. What did we give you? You're definitely on for one. There you are, the Bland Soldier.
Oh, right.
Yep, you're doing that one.
I've actually been looking at that one in some detail recently, so hopefully I can remember around it.
Well, it's going to be the shortest ever Watson watch.
Yes.
I know that. Because he's not in it. But thank you so much for coming on. And thank you for changing my mind mostly on the Golden Ponds night.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to thank our hosts at Rippercast, as well as producers Jonathan Mengus and John Rees. A special thank you too to Andrew Firth, who created both the graphics and the theme music. You can contact us on Twitter at Adler to Amberley. Thank you for listening. Okay,
is it Pontsney? Is it Pontsney, the pronunciation?
I'm going to go with Pons. Pons, and I'm going to go with.
Unfortunately, I will probably say Pasney.
Okay, well, we can talk about that. That's fair enough. I'm
going to say
Pinsnez.
Just
Pinsnez, yeah.
That's
I'm
probably the English way of saying it. I'm being French and saying Pasney.
Is it literally Pinch's nose?
Yes, it's grip
nose.
Means?
Yeah, grip nose, yeah. Okay, we'll get into this then.